Greetings, everybody. Since I've last been with you, obviously the world has changed a lot because of COVID-19. This episode was previously recorded right before shit hit the fan. Pardon my language. And I think it has a lot of important lessons for all of us as we'd look to manage going forward. But if you're wondering why we don't mention coronavirus really much in this episode, that's why. Here's the show.
One of the challenges you have, if you're managing company with people, how do you turn your employees into those fans, the ones that say, "I'm so bloody passionate about it. It rocks my boat and it's meaningful to me, not just a paycheck at the end of the week."
Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and this is Future Proof. Today, I am very excited to have with us somebody who I've known for a while, even by reputation before I knew him in person, which is always good when you know people who have a certain degree of notoriety in a good way. So Minter Dial, in addition to having one of the cooler names out of anybody who I know, he also has had some of the most interesting experiences from a professional standpoint. He had a 16-year international career at L'Oréal, like me, except I did not last nearly as long. After that, he returned to his entrepreneurial roots to become a thought leader, author, consultant, and professional speaker. He's worked with some little-known companies that you probably haven't heard of, like Google and Samsung, to help activate their brand strategies. He is, really works as a catalyzing agent to help companies change their mindsets, to up their digital transformation. And what I love about this guy is, you'll hear a little bit more about this, but you can't really put him in a box. That's one thing that I really try to say about myself also. But I'm going to save a few surprises for a few interesting things that he's worked on and he is working on now. Minter, welcome to Future Proof.
Jeremy, thank you very much.
Hopefully that was a decent intro, but I feel
Excellent. Excellent.
it because it's tough, right? But when you've done enough things and you try to encapsulate yourself in, a short little bio, it's difficult, right?
Especially as you get older. You've accumulated things. I mean, especially if you change, but if even as you get older, you're always having more things that you could possibly add into your bio.
Minter's 25. I know that this is not a video podcast, but
55,
you'll say,
55.
Yeah, tomato, tomato. So, as I like to start out by asking people, who the heck are you and what do you do on a day-to-day basis?
Well, I try to make every day a different day, and that's what I enjoy. Who am I? I'm a bohemian itinerant. That's what I like to say. I've changed countries 15 times and homes 34 times, and only have one wife, which is the way I plan to keep it. But for the rest, it's been about change. I've enjoyed working in something like 12 different industries. I've done 15 different types of jobs, including being a tennis pro and now a writer. And I like to think of myself as an observer and listener.
And I think that you're also being modest because last I checked, you've written three books.
Published three books.
Published three books. One thing that I wish I could say about myself is having an award-winning documentary under my belt. At least I'm in the room with somebody who has one, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, that was an exceptional experience because, of course, like you and I, we came from doing 30-second spots, and all of a sudden there I was actually mucking, mucking it up, trying to do a full length, or at least it turned out to be 27-minute film. We cut about 8 or 9 hours down to 27 minutes. It was a 25-year film project that ended up being, now it's been shown on television quite a lot, and PBS, usually on Memorial Day and Veterans Day in North America, and I'm very proud of that.
Yeah, which I will have to definitely include in the show notes. I think that could be a whole nother conversation, to be honest. I wanted to, I think, maybe even first start with something which is another interesting fact, which is you've actually written a book called Future Proof.
I did. That was my second book, published by Pearson, co-written with my friend Caleb Storkey. It was actually my editor's idea, the word future-proof, so I can't take credit for that.
Well, what's funny is that I remember, and I don't know if you remember this is like a conversation back in Dublin, maybe we had in like 2015 or something like that, 2014, I don't know. And I feel like I was mentioning this where, you know, where I say that this is a thing that a lot of people are concerned about, the future. It looks a lot, very uncertain. Things are moving very quickly, and it's going to be important for people to future-proof themselves and to be protected of all of this uncertainty. And I feel like I almost like remember the street, and I might be remembering the conversation wrong, but almost like that word kind of sparking.
You seeded it.
Yeah. I mean, I'll take like a kernel of credit, but who cares? The important thing I feel like is you put ideas out into the world and you get this based off of your consulting is you just hope that you can have some impact. Obviously, there are dollars at stake if you get some type of consulting agreement, but it's about what type of change that you can impact like the organization with, right?
Well, for sure, you don't make a lot of money selling books. At least I haven't.
Shocker. As a only two-time author, I'm well aware. Yeah, it's exactly. Really everything else that surrounds the book itself.
And going back to the film, The Last Ring Home, even less money making a documentary film. What are my ideas between my books, the two I've already done and one coming out, is I think of them more like a Trojan horse. I want to get into the company. I want to help them to be more productive. But ultimately, what I want them to do, and it runs through each of these books, is to have more profundity and more meaningfulness injected into what they're doing. Because underneath that, you could use the other word, the why, that Simon Sinek has made famous. But that's what I'm trying to do, is I use these books as hooks to get into the company and help them understand how to get to the why.
Okay, so speaking of the why don't I jump in with a little irreverent lightning round that has nothing to do with anything else? Okay.
Why not?
Why not? Yeah. Okay. What is the first word that comes to mind when you think of your time at L'Oreal?
Lipstick.
Okay, fine. How about, since we're on the topic of companies, one word for Google and Samsung apiece, since I gave them some lip service a minute ago.
To each of them.
Yeah.
Google Alphabet and Samsung Chaiball.
Okay. Fair enough. What, since you speak in a lot of different places, what would you say your favorite city to have made an appearance is?
Ooh. Well, I think I would have to associate that with the people who are organizing it as opposed to necessarily the city in which it was and the kind of environment I have. I've had a great fun doing events in Exeter in the UK. It's a kind of a kooky, cool kind of place. And the type of people is like minds is the name of the conference. And so you just hang out with really interesting people and talk in a way that's less highfalutin and down to earth and quite pragmatic. So that would be my favorite. Exeter, UK.
Since you have interviewed quite a few people in your time, who is probably the number one target of yours that you have yet to interview?
Oh, wow. I have a constant list, Jeremy. I've done, in between my French and English podcast, 500. So I've gotten a good number in them. Who would I like to have? I would say Richard Branson would be fun to have. I'd also...
I thought you were going to say Richard Pryor.
That's because you're a comedian.
That's
true. Yeah, exactly. No, so, I mean, I have a bunch of other people, but I've been blessed to have had some wonderful guests, and I've had a few on, like yourself, several times, so...
Yeah, I think you've really amassed a great. And another thing for me to include in the show notes is a link to some of the great conversations that Minter's had over the years. And one other lightning round question. These have been a little bit too PG. I like to mix it up a little bit. But for some reason, I'm in a very chill mood today. I'll just say, what are the 8 languages that you can get by in?
Oh, right. So I have to remember them, right? So let's start with good old English, French, Spanish, Italian. Those are the ones I sort of speak better. And then I get by in Russian, German, Japanese, and Zulu.
Well, I don't know if that counts because I feel like, I mean, everybody knows Zulu. Yeah.
Well.
I convinced a lot of people that I knew how to speak Aleutian Eskimo. It's a great thing to try to convince people
wiggle noses.
It works really well because you never run into anybody who can call you out on that. So it's actually like, so.
Well, for to be real, in Zulu and Japanese, I really went about learning 300 words and try to put them together in string sentences with quite bastardized grammar, so.
By the way, Portuguese is not that hard.
Well, I don't have it. I can understand it quite easily, but it's not up on my list.
Okay, so by the time we interview you next, hopefully, you know. So, I mean, I think that I wanted to ask you a little bit about artificial empathy, heartificial, if you guys didn't hear that properly. I think it's, first off, very cool name for a book.
Thank you.
Really enjoyed it. And I love that, like, you're looking at why and how brands should learn to flex that empathetic muscle that most of them don't really have, you know? So I'm curious, what inspired you to write it in the first place? And where do you think empathy is going as a hot button issue?
So I'm going to give you the real answer, Jeremy, which is
you got a nice advance.
No, it's my self-published. Is that I was writing another book. And my editor came down with a very serious illness, and we had to put that book on hold. Almost at the very same time, I lost my best friend to suicide. And having accompanied him through that, the last few weeks of his life, thinking about what I could have done differently, not that I was blaming myself, but I really understood that it was an opportunity to practice empathy. And that was the sort of stimulus for getting me on the bandwagon, if you will, for doing something about it. So that was what drove me, and you know, every morning behind what I was doing. Afterwards, I, of course, have a strong feeling about it being relevant for our society in general and in business specifically, because while I'd like to be able to talk to society, I have a better audience in business. And I think that business can be a force for change. I think right now it's more about running people into the ground, burning people out, and therefore what we need to have in business is a desire to be more empathic. Study after study show that people don't feel like they can trust their bosses, feel like they can't be vulnerable in an organization because, hey, they're going to be judged for I'm being weak or, you know, I'm a sissy. And I think that's the opposite of what we need. And on top of that, that actually is what will help make your brand more authentic towards the customer.
Yeah, I mean, I think the other thing that's really interesting to me about it is, and I don't know if you thought about it in terms of this way, is there's a movement towards commoditizing every single one of us. You know, you can go on Upwork and you can find 1,000 people who can do the same thing in, you know, a fraction of a second. And I think that relationships are inherently human, and you're going to do business on an ongoing basis with somebody who you have a relationship with, even if you know that there's somebody 1% better out there. You know, like, we think that we're rational and we're going to go with the person who's 1% better, but we're not. And I think that in some ways, like, that's also true about what the relationship that consumers have with brands, you know, right? I mean, you build a relationship with a brand, and you're not, you have blinders on to some extent if you have a really strong relationship with the brand, if they've shown you empathy.
Well, I think you're right, Jeremy. The challenge at some level is that not only are we being commoditized, or at least there are alternatives to us to be gigged out or use a machine to do us better, but I think we have a fundamental lack of trust in our organization. And so if we are looking to commoditize, maybe we should look at ourselves and say, what do we think about humanity in general? And this issue of trust is really big because it really underscores your relationship. If you have trust in the people, then even if they're not the perfect person for the job in terms of expertise, you trust them, you know them, you know how they roll. They're going to deal with your foibles, and that's going to be a better combination than having the perfect person who might be super efficient and the commodity, if you will, that's been fine-tuned to the messier, more enjoyable, longer-term relationship.
Yeah, it's just very interesting to me how I think everybody thinks that, you're going to find something better out there. But I think, if you've ever read The Paradox of Choice, I think that there's a lot of data out there to suggest that people want to have a strong relationship with a brand, let's say, or with, a supplier, a vendor, if you're on the B2B side, as opposed to just constantly looking out there for something better. It actually stresses us out, and we don't necessarily wind up with something better as a result.
I can't remember who wrote it. Oh, yes, it was David Meerman Scott in Fanocracy. He wrote about the fact that we really, in a large size survey, only have 2.5 passions possible. And so, like you're talking about this brands, rarely do brands fit into that passion level. So one of the challenges you have, especially if you're an employee, is how do you, if you're managing company with people, how do you turn your employees into those fans, the ones that say, I'm so bloody passionate about it. It rocks my boat and it's meaningful to me, not just a paycheck at the end of the week.
Yeah. I mean, what do you think? I mean, do you think that empathy in general is a greater opportunity in terms of marketing to your consumers, or in terms of actually connecting with your own employees, or is it both?
So, great question, Jeremy. The way I like to talk about it, and this is sort of the Trojan horse approach, it's a great way to make more money. But if you sidestep or do a short circuiting of actually embedding empathy within the organization, then it won't be a long-term plan as far as making money is concerned. So the point is that, of course, it's great to be able to be better in touch with your consumers, be smarter at the way you wordsmith your marketing messages. But if you're only applying your empathy outwards and you're being a slave driver to all the employees and slapping them silly and saying, be more empathic with your customers, then there's no way it's going to get better.
Yeah, I mean, it's just basically a matter of being two-faced.
That's right. Well, yeah. Empathy washing is what I would call it, but I mean, I think it's still relevant to focus on trying to be more empathic towards your externals, whether it's in a B2B or B2C, and how you interact with your customers, because, by the way, they pay us and that's relevant. Yet, do you not want to have inconsistency in the way you are? So you're not going to drive a culture of empathy towards the customer and not be empathic within. So get with the program, start with empathy within, just like I did in Future Proof, by the way. Everything actually should start with the individual, you, and self-empathy. And then start thinking about your relationships with the people you're working with and how can you do that better. By the way, it's great for things like innovation, design. And then finally, think about the way you want to express your brand and your company outwards to your customers.
What do you think about the trend of obviously, incorporating AI into all of your business processes? And it's not even a trend, it's what's happening, getting true AI and figuring out ways how it can better virtually every single part of your company. But then at the same time, I think what's interesting is people get a little bit scared of AI and they think of it as cold. And I think, you make an interesting argument that you can actually encode, empathy into AI as you're deploying it, right? So you'd talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. Well, so starting with AI, like so many of these technologies, it's a choice you have. And today, unless you're living in a dark hole, it's hard to imagine not having explored it. If you haven't created a strategy, which can also, by the way, include we're not going to use AI because we believe in slow time, we believe in, let's say, another form of process, then make your choices. But at least you have a strategy, which is something that many companies are still missing, having an AI strategy. The second point to that is actually linking what you're doing with AI into what is strategically important for you. It's not just because you can do it that you should do it. Is it where you need to be focusing your resources? And so that's the first part with regard to AI. And so obviously there's a lot to be said for that. Where my book, Artificial Empathy, I talk about AI is some companies would rather delegate their empathy. That was maybe another way of saying, well, having my sales assistants be empathic, but not being worried about it within the company. Same with AI. If you want your chatbot to be empathic with customers who are calling in, but the rest of your team, the human beings, are not, then just that won't work. Secondly, if you're not empathically programmed within the company as people, then how are you possibly going to encode your bot to be empathic? Because you don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's kind of like if you really want to clone your dog, you know, start out with a good dog in the first place. You know? So if you really want to deploy AI properly, then figure out how you get the right people who've got the right ethos.
The right products.
Yeah, yeah. But I think it's interesting, though, to me, like how you actually scale. I've spoken to a lot of people who... I'm surprised that I know at this point, like, enough people who are running companies that are valued at over $1 billion. And they obviously expanded pretty significantly in the short time period, right? So finding those people who have that empathic ethos and across the company is probably important. And then another thing is that I think it's really personally important, you know, in certain job functions, maybe not as much in others. I mean, I don't know. I mean, would you agree or disagree that it's more important to have an empathic customer service team than an accounting team?
Right. Well, good point. Well, as soon as we have relationships, empathy is useful. So an accounting team is still a bunch of people hanging out and doing work. Granted, their work is going to be on computers and punching in numbers. But even there, empathy can be useful. And you're not going to be, as a CEO, non-empathic to the accounting team and empathic just with the customer service. This is about instituting a culture of empathy within the organization. And then afterwards, in terms of some jobs have more benefit than others, I would call designers. Anyone who's doing anything with design should have a high regard for empathy, the skills of empathy within it. Customer service, marketing, everything to do with thinking it through in the customer's shoes. How would they like to receive an email at 8:55 on a Monday morning? Not. How are you going to wordsmith it so it's a way that they're really enticed and feel, this is speaking to me. This is where marketing, innovation, if you want to be really innovative, and there are many companies who have really made a point of connecting empathy with the innovation cycle.
Yeah, I was going to say, actually, because I know you talk a little bit about that. So you've got a few examples at the ready, but who's doing a good job at that? Who's a little bit ahead of the market that other people are paying attention to with respect to, you know, incorporating empathy into all their business processes?
Well, so afterwards, nothing is perfect, Jeremy. And I am not part of the company. So I'm, I can have some people who might be listening to this and say, well, I work there and that's not happening.
You'll find that about Patagonia. Somebody will be like, exactly. Oh, Patagonia makes me go outdoors too much. You know, like there's always going to be somebody.
Exactly. So one massive example is Microsoft. Satya Nadella, with certainly influenced by his Indian background, but has truly thought of empathy, and he talks about it quite a lot as being a very important part of his culture and how he wants to make his company and how they're using that to be more innovative within the company. And they've done quite a good job, frankly, under him. So I think that that's a pretty good indicator.
Did you say him because did I tell you he's going to be on next week?
No.
He's not. Yeah. No. But, wow. but he might be listening to this, in which case his team will
definitely want him
us.
Too.
So he's, yeah.
We're on him. I speak about him fairly frequently when I'm on stage as pointing to, you can have the ambition of empathy even at scale, because the challenge with human relationships is that it's really quite messy, and mostly run by men who have gone through business schools and thought productivity and efficiencies are the only thing that count. Well, what we're getting into is this appreciation of the messiness of human relationships. And that's where empathy plays its role. I mean, it's not just cognitive empathy. You can have affective empathy, which is all about feeling feelings and allowing for vulnerability in a company. And so it takes a certain stature of a person to be able to do it. Airbnb has done a pretty good job with that as well. The guy running it, Chesky. Then I think Warby Parker has been doing a great job to be local to you.
Well, I think, exactly. There are, it was created very close by. So, I mean, perfect example, though, is when you're thinking about, obviously, this idea of empathy, I think a lot of people, they hear that, and then they might just say, oh, it's like being customer-centric, right? But how is it different? It sounds like it's really talking about it as a core tenant of a brand and just letting it permeate everything, as opposed to just thinking about it, having it in your customer service team and, you know, having that be that.
Well, I love the fact that you bring up customer centricity. It's sort of, it became trendy about maybe the same time we were in Dublin, because people were saying, well, you know, the customer's important, the customer pays, and yada, yada, yada. But it was such an obvious next step to digital, because digital turns the power or rebalances the power into the hands of the customer. So, the customer's back in. My point actually is that we need, and I've written about this, is actually we need to be employee-centric. And in fact, I've now gone to a new term, which is employee-first customer centricity. And that's because you have now many more people engaging with customers. You do it through different channels. You might do it through a screen with fingers or not, but there are still fingers touched, you know, managed by a person.
Well, I would say, by the way, this is almost like the idea of, and I don't know if we can make this term, you know, pop, but constituent centricity. It's too long. It's not going to work. But the idea of, like the employee is your constituent in that moment. They're not a consumer, but, you know, like being consumer centric is also in a certain moment what you need to be focused on. And it's just very, I don't know. I don't want to be like the cynical marketer who's been around too long, but part of me thinks like, why do brand, like, isn't it sad that this is a thing that you have to write about, that people have to, you know, hey, it turns out we should focus on our customers. Like, why is this a thing that brands have gotten so far away from that they actually need to be told this in the first place?
Well, we have to be nuanced, because of course so many of these companies do have individuals who think about customers and they think that they're doing everything for the customer. The challenge is you have an enormous set of tools and objectives that you have to reach as a CEO. And so you're looking at factories and the productivity and so on. You're looking at your supply chain and that. And then you have to look at sustainable development and are you being friendly to the environment? And all of a sudden, I've got a lot of things to talk about and I haven't mentioned the customer. And ironically, we're talking about customer service. It's basically the one part of most companies that aren't in-housed. They like to out-house it. If they have it with in-house, they like to put it in the cheapest part, like the warehouse or nearby the factory. And it's the only department in the entire company that has the word customer in it.
Well, but okay, so I want to challenge you on one thing, because whenever I was brand side, and for all of the brands that I've ever consulted with, I think it's safe to say that virtually every single one of them had a greater customer acquisition budget than customer, you know, loyalty, right? Like, I think that is definitely a thing that I saw consistently. So, and then also in terms of employee development, if you want to take that as a proxy measure for do you care about empathy internally, right? I mean, it's not like the human resources departments are naturally like thinking that much about empathy. I've seen even, you know, like when it comes to recruiting, I've seen companies where they destroy their reputation simply because they do such a bad job at the recruiting standpoint. So this is, again, like maybe a little bit more cynical than I normally am, but I almost think, how much of it is something that brands should be paying attention to or say that they care about, but then if you're following the dollars and cents, are they actually making the investments that they need to represent that this is something really important?
Well, I'm not sure where you disagree, because in the end of the day, my point is that we've had so many other things to think about that we've lost the plot with regard to customers. And being focused on things like profitability and the performances, which can be the KPIs that you're looking for, which include productivity, performances, and so on. Well, we've moved away from it. And so if we focus on customer acquisition, well, actually what I believe is we're focusing on pre-customers, because you haven't made a customer. And if you don't know how to keep a customer, why bother running off to get one? So what I think companies need to be doing is thinking about the fidelity of their customers. And the only way you're going to really have that as a culture is if you have fidelity within your employees. Notwithstanding the fact that there are relationships, but I don't think of it as like, you know, you're a hairdresser with a book of you know, 500 clients. That's not the way I'm thinking about this. But I think that if you have a mindset of wanting to developing meaningful relationships, which means that I'm prepared to cultivate and keep customers for the long haul, I'm prepared to go the extra mile, not going to forget that they exist and take them for granted, running off the new shiny object kind of feeling of customer acquisition.
It's interesting, and I know I'm gonna like bring this into a totally different area, but since we're talking about human relationships, right? I mean, I think I kind of liken it to, you know, there are a lot of people who are dating, and they tend to do their hair. They try to look as good as possible while they're trying to woo somebody. Then they get them, and then maybe bit by bit, they don't do their hair as much or their makeup. And I'm not talking about women because I wear foundation as well. I'm saying that, you know, just after, is it inherently in human nature to care about people during this almost acquisition process while you're wooing them? You know, it could be the same thing for when you're wooing an employee to join your team, and then things get real afterwards. And
there's
then
an excitement to that buzz of the first time, first kiss. And I think that is part of the human psyche.
And that's why it's like, if that's part of the human condition, is there any value in us trying to change it if it's a thing that maybe 100 years from now, 200 years from now, will still be endemic to like human society? I'm always trying to separate out what makes us who we are that's not even worth trying to change because it is what it is, and what are the things that we actually can affect.
Right. So we should be exploring dating versus marrying?
We should. It does go that route. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I compare everything to that. It's once you get something, once you close the deal, you know, and you sell in, you know, the biggest package that you've ever had, like as a consultant, are you as good to that person the next day as you were the day before? Not you, but I'm saying in general, like I feel like it might be something that is just human nature, in which case, how do we, you know, short of, you know, putting a chip in all of our brains, how do we whip that out of our, you know, us?
Well, so my first feeling is that there are always going to be paradoxes and tensions in no matter what we do. If we only do dating, then we'll have a thing, we might have a problem like children and society, we'll have other things to deal with. I feel like in the way we are progressing, the one thing which is common and needs to be, I would say, put back on the table is conversation and community. And if you're only dating, which means you're only having my initial reaction and telling you top line superficial stuff, then we're not developing real conversations. And so I think that within the space that we have today, where we see what some people are terming a loneliness epidemic, where in the UK we actually have a minister of loneliness.
Sorry to interrupt, but isn't Brexit going to make things a little bit more lonely?
All right, so Brexit is a different topic.
That's a whole nother. We'll do a 5-hour episode right. One day and include that.
I think that the issue we have is, I mean, if we go back to this notion of dating story, with empathy, there are three categories of empathy that's interesting. One is empathy with people you know and love, your friends, your family. There's empathy with your work people. And then there is empathy with strangers. And it's true that I feel in society today, we have tremendous difficulty to have empathy with strangers because they're the enemy. We don't know them. We're scared of them. And we're flying away from them because we have other preoccupations. At work, empathy is not happening. The studies show it systematically. That's not happening at work. And then there's an ironic element, which is that it can often be very difficult to sustain empathy with the longer-term relationships that you have, because it means listening to them without the ego and the baggage to have a pure understanding of the context and what's being said.
It's interesting that you say that, because part of what I was almost going to argue is, or just wonder, honestly, out loud, is, you know, as you've probably seen, you have a lot of, you know, shorter tenures, especially among American companies. I haven't looked at international data. But my little mini hypothesis is that if you know that you're not working with this team, if a lot of teams are basically created on the fly and more or less they break apart relatively quickly, do you have less of an incentive to even build empathy within a team if you're like, what do I really care about these people? I'm not going to be working with them in a few weeks.
Well, it's back to the why. If your why is I'm only here to do the sellout, In other words, build a business and in 3 years sell it out, go public, and then go off on my boat. Then I think that's a model. I just think it's a really very wasteful model, and a lot of damage will be along the way. So, you know, I'm not going to maybe judge every company, but I do feel that if you don't have a why, that's sort of the angle that people take. And so what is the meaningfulness? What purpose? One of the questions, Jeremy, I like to ask is, how would the world be worse off without your brand? And if you do not have an answer to that question, then you don't have a real why.
I'm literally, if anybody can see me right now, I'm literally thinking deep into space about what you just said, because I think it's true that a lot of brands, especially, you know, brands that are aspiring to be the next Google or Facebook or Bloomberg or whatever, they're not thinking enough about the why. They're thinking, well, I see a market opportunity
here. I can be a unicorn.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I'm going to solve a problem, but without going a little bit deeper than that. And it is interesting to see that the companies that look like they could have succeeded, but then don't quite succeed, that lack of a why, to me, seems to be relatively constant. It's that and bad management. And I don't know. I was just thinking about that because a lot of the talks I'm giving this year on how to predict this, you know, successful startup of tomorrow. And I mean, I think that this empathy or lack thereof is something that I should probably do some research into. Do these companies, are they more empathetic? You know, do they build their team and morale that way and get all aligned and know that they have a firm reason for existing?
I've been of the school that I'd prefer to invest in a team of great people than in a product that looks fantastic.
Yeah.
I may be wrong in certain cases, there's no doubt. And I have baggage to say that I was wrong as choosing some of my partners in my life in terms of businesses. I had companies that went bankrupt.
And by the way, though, that's the danger of small data, because, you know, you have that experience and then you say, well, this is what I've learned from it. But the truth of the matter is that there's a recency or proximity bias, so that if something has happened to you, and then I got mugged on 86th Street in Lexington.
So it's dangerous around here.
Right. We're recording a few blocks away. I don't think I've told our producer, Adam, this, but I got mugged on 86th and Lex. It was like 30 years ago. But you know what? Had I never gone on that corner again, I would have been like, wow, I get mugged a decent amount of the time on 86th and Lex, right?
But small data.
And I've probably been on that corner about 3,000 times since then. So I know that it's just this interesting thing where, you know, when you're talking to companies, how hard is it to get them to break out of their little bias towards, well, this is our experience here, because you, as the consultant, you've spoken to a lot of people, you've spoken to a lot of companies, and you're able to bring in all this data from, I've surveyed a number of different companies simultaneously, and this is what the data shows.
Well, I still think, though, that one needs to have a strong opinion sometimes. And that means stand up for something. It may not be the big data, but it is my personal conviction. And sometimes you do need to have that conviction, which is going to piss off some people, which isn't necessarily 100% right. Well, actually, of course, never 100% right. But so stand up for that. And so within my approach, if I were to start up a VC company, that would be my top line. We believe in people.
But doesn't it have, and this is to me, I think the thing that I think is very interesting is that, you know, when you're trying to create the future, you're right. You definitely need to have a certain conviction. But then also at the same time, it needs to be backed with data in some way to make your argument. Or you could be very convincing without data. Like, that's always a possibility, right?
You're right. I mean, of course, I will look at data and I'll look at things like industries. In today's world, if you are looking to go into business, you better look very closely at the industry you're going into, because there are some crap industries that are bound to suffer. And like distribution in general is one example, or retail. But then there are others which are more exciting, maybe more volatile. Depends what you want. But and therefore you need to have some data. And you know, I ran big business, so of course I was always looking at P&Ls and making sure that my market research, but you know, data numbers, you can use numbers to spin a bunch of things.
And I think.
So how do you then get around that? Because I think that, like you said, you're somebody who, if I pinned you down, you have a few things that you believe very strongly that you consult and speak on, right? How much data needs to be given to you that challenges a particular belief that you have before you start to say, well, you know what, maybe I was wrong, or let me reverse course? Because this is something, admittedly, that I struggle with, is I always say my job is to be as impartial as possible and to be kind of like the data, the android on the Next Generation, Star Trek, which I loved. You know, he was just like the most pragmatic, like you gave him new data, he would assimilate it and he could change his opinion in a second, you know? So it's kind of like, how do you balance having conviction, but being able to change that conviction when the situation, calls for it?
Well, my trite answer is I make sure I get a strong data scientist beside me. What I'm good at, Jeremy, is looking at the human dimension and the cultural aspects of business. And speaking of specific choices, being strategic, what I observe is that you can run after more data, but if you don't really actually have a good strategy, which is shared and commonly understood by the entire organization, I don't really care how much data you have. It's not going to work. So back to my, I'd rather have a boat that's filled with people that are getting along properly, that maybe not each of them the expert in their field, but have a conviction that's going maybe not due north, but towards an objective that hopefully is towards the north, and that's going to work better. And that's what I do. And I think that the issue of strategy is not to be underspoken, because it's amazing how many times I'll go into a company and I ask them, what's your strategy? And well, everyone starts looking down at their feet. I'm like, well, that wasn't a trick question. What is the strategy? And if I pull them off separately and ask the question, I generally get different answers from each individual. And the issue about strategy is that we actually, that's the choice of what we're doing. And of course, people are going to get bogged down into the different strategies of the little tactics and the little other things that I'm trying to do, but they lose touch with the bigger strategy. And the issue with that strategy is that if they don't have one, well, then people are going to be spending their resources on different ideas and different egos and different parts of the organization. But they need to have something unifying factor. And above the strategy should be your why.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's really interesting. How about, since I know that you are working, am I allowed to say that you're working on a book later on this year?
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about the topic.
So it's going to be out in October, published by Kogan Page. And the topic is leadership. And the title is You Lead, How Being Yourself Will Make You a Better Leader.
I love that topic. I mean, I think for me, what I kind of like about you is that I see a lot of myself. And you always try to surround yourself with people you can learn from, or people where you're like, that person seems cool because they're like me. And if they're cool, then I'm cool, right? It's almost like this, like complimenting myself. But I love that you have the ability to study a number of different disciplines and a number of different topics. And have you thought a little bit about, does that make you a better futurist, for lack of a better term, the fact that you're surveying a number of different topics simultaneously?
Well, I'm definitely more of the comb variety, if you know the difference between the T-shaped, the pie-shaped, and the cones.
So I do, but tell our listeners.
Right, so it's very visual. So T-shape is when you have one deep understanding, one deep expertise. Pie-shaped is you have a little top, and then you have two legs of the symbol pi, P-I, and that's, you have two expertises. The comb is you have many teeth, and so I'm much more of the teeth variety. I've done a lot of stuff. I'm great at nothing, and I'm certainly not an expert in anything. And I'd rather not be called a futurist. I'm a future proofer, which is a bit different, because really what I'm looking at is how to make your organization future proof. And technology and the way the future of technologies is going to evolve is not as much what I'm interested in. I'm thinking more about how you as an organization are going to get ready for that. And why are you in business? There's a great test I like to do. I wanted to tell you about that before, but I slip it in now.
Yeah.
It's called the brand tattoo test. And you mentioned before companies may be only working for 2 to 3 years,
I go in and I like to say, so how many people in this company would like to have a tattoo of their company put on some part of their body?
Hmm.
And I'm not necessarily saying the logo, but something that represents the company. So I give them a little bit of leeway, you know, hey, could it be the, you know, signal, the color of...
Immediately in my head, I was thinking, what if I worked at Tampax and you gave me that? I don't know why, but okay, sorry.
Right. So, and the point is that you're working for a company and it's necessarily a transient story. I mean, of course, there's some people who die on the job and so on, but bottom line is you're working in a company. It's only supposed to be a stint of your life, even if it's 35 years. But even if you're working for 1 year, 2 year, 3 years, how can you move your company and your brand towards the type of brand that people want to tattoo their body with in full knowledge of the fact that they're going to be leaving that company?
Yeah, I love that.
And the concept there is really about the culture and what you're doing on this earth. So if you can create that kind of a business which says that I know that if my company disappeared, the world would be worse off. Even if I leave that company, Patagonia, or some such, then I know that I still feel the things I felt for that company, even though I'm no longer working for them.
I love that, but also brands are just popping into my head at the same time. I'm like, if I worked at Arby's and I just had a giant Arby's tattoo on my butt.
Well, if you got stoned before that, you might, you know, feel like the Arby's is really good and get a tattoo at the same time. So you, I mean, obviously this tattoo story is,
no,
is
this
only
is amazing.
Allegorical.
It is, I really think it's like one of those things where ultimately it is the best way to, because frankly, look at the brands that are succeeding in our world. I mean, for all the people who hate Facebook, there are a lot of people who would probably get the Facebook tattooed, or Netflix or Apple or Amazon, you know. The Warby Parkers of the world, right? Those are companies that people have a strong affinity for. And frankly, I think it's okay if some people hate you and hate your brand because they just don't have to buy. You can't buy negative X units of a particular product, right? So it's okay if you're not for everybody. You have to sometimes narrow cast and to mean something very strong to some people and have some people despise you. And I think that's okay.
Oh God, if you're trying to do anything else, I think you're going up the wrong tree. You need to stand for something. And that necessarily means you need to stand for not something. And in this world where we've become a little bit too polished and I would say politically correct, where you can't say anything wrong about anybody else. In the end of the day, I think this is one of the challenges we have in business. We need to be able to say, this is who I am. This is my tribe. This is not my tribe. And as soon as I say, this is not my tribe, then I'm being an ist of some sort. I'm a not a PNGist or whatever it could be. Then, well, but that's okay. And in fact, that's what we need to do. We need to belong to a community. And then I write about this in my new book, You Lead, once you identify your community, you also need to help the individual exist. Because if you don't, if you try to uniformize too much, then the individual will erupt and want to become and you know, demonstrate him or herself. So you need to have that understanding of the individual within a community. And that's one of the four paradoxes I talk about in my book, my new book, which I think is really important. And the counterpart of that is you also need to not belong.
Yeah. Yeah. Life is about making choices. And I think that the more that brands kind of get ideas like this, the more likely they are to succeed. So,
and the challenge back to the point before is that sometimes the performance pressure to grow, I'm big, I got to get bigger. And which means, I want to say yes to every customer. Well, then that's a perfect example of how I'm not going to be customer-centric. Because if you try to please everybody, you will please nobody.
And I love that. I feel like we can't even end on a possibly better note than that. So, Minder, thank you so much. This was really fantastic.
My pleasure, Jeremy. Thanks for having me on the show.
And thanks again, Minder, for joining us. I told you he was an interesting guy. Definitely one of the better itinerant bohemians that we've had on the show, at least in the top five of those. If you liked what you heard today, please rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, wherever finer podcasts are sold. If you're not a subscriber already, first off, what's wrong with you? And second off, please be sure to join now that I've offended you. Once again, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and you've been listening to Future Proof.